I am delighted to be here and see some old faces that I haven't seen for a while and be a part of this again. Mostly I think it's important for me to say that I'm grateful for God to allow me to be anywhere. Because given my past and that sort of thing, that certainly wasn't the writing on the wall that I saw. I wouldn't have been here. So I thank you all for that. Daryl and I stayed at a wonderful place last night. We thought maybe we might want to, next time we're invited somewhere, to see if we can get places like that to stay again. And more often, we thought we deserved it. My dry day's December 3rd, 1964. That was the day that I got off of a Greyhound bus. Let me back up just a little bit. I was out on my own. I'd been kicked out of the house. I'd been married, and we had three little girls, and real little girls. And I had been asked to leave the house, and so I had gone out and moved in with the Ham's beer distributor, which I thought was a remarkable move. But after a couple of days, he'd had enough of it, and so I was kind of homeless again, and went down, wrote a bad check for enough to start drinking again, and kind of got going. And that guy threw me out because I'd written him a bad check, which wasn't unusual. I wrote a lot of bad checks to a lot of bartenders. That was back when all you had was counter checks. Every bank in town would have counter checks on the back bar. You come in and say, give me a checkbook. And they'd say, okay, which bank? And it didn't matter. I didn't have an account in any of them. I'd write a check for enough to get me started drinking. And it'd be kind of how it started. But I had to leave the bar I was in, and I called home and thinking to find a way to get back in the house. And Julie answered the phone, my bride, she's still my bride, and forgot how long that is, 56, 57 years, isn't it? Yeah. And told her I'd like to see the kids, and she said, fine, come on over. And I thought, man, I'm back in the house. Everything's cool, you know, back in the big bed. So we get there, and her dad was there. Yeah, oh, we had that talk. I sat down with her dad, and we discussed the situation. Mostly it's, what do we do with Gary, you know? And back at that point in time, there were no treatment centers or dinner joints or anything such things around there. And all they knew about was the Wyoming State Hospital, 400 miles away from Cheyenne. We knew that her uncle was bad to drink, and he had gone there any number of times. In fact, he died on the way up there for his last trip. They had him in a truck. They're going to haul him back to the nest out in that house, and he went into alcoholic withdrawal and died on the way. It didn't happen to me. I'd agreed to go to the nut house, and I told Julie's dad that I would go if he'd take me. It's only 400 miles. What the hell? He said, no, I won't do that, but I'll put you on the bus. And he did. He put me on the bus, and I got off in Rock Springs to buy a pint, and then that pint got me the rest of the way to the hospital. And there was a cop standing there, and I didn't pay much attention to him, but I'm looking at this hospital. Evanston's a small town, and there's a mountain right over here, and the side of that mountain is this old nut house. And I kind of stand there looking at it because it looks like an opening shot to a horror movie when you're looking at it up there. The cop asked me, he says, you going up there? How do you know? Said, yeah. He said, you want a ride? And I said, sure. That wasn't the first cop to give me a ride somewhere. But so anyway, that was the start of things in there. They actually had a program there for alcoholics, and that was pretty unusual back in 1964. That was very unusual. with that, and it was mostly AA and that sort of thing, but I didn't know it. They asked me if I'd come in to participate in their alcoholic rehabilitation program, and that sounded good enough to me. I was, at that point, I'm numb, and I'll just do anything you tell me. The pain was so bad. I just didn't care. We talk about the hole in the belly with the wind blowing through it, and I'd woken up to that every time I didn't have booze around. And if I didn't have booze around, it stayed with me. It didn't go away. The only thing that ever took it away from me was the... I'm 16 years old. I'm backflashing a little bit. And two other fellas and myself had driven from Cheyenne to Laramie to go to the state basketball tournament. And we did that. The two guys I was with had nerve enough to talk to girls, and so they got this couple of girls to go riding with us. And we decided we needed some liquor. And so I found a guy to buy us a quart of Four Roses whiskey. And we stopped and got some Coke, and that's Coca-Cola. You got to explain that anymore. And we had the booze in the car, and we had the girls in the car, and we took off to the boondocks. Years, few years later, I got to thinking about that night. We had them in the car and all that, like I'm telling you about. But we didn't know what to do with either one. That you couldn't go buy the magazines at the drugstore like you can now. That explained all that. But we went out, and the first time we passed the bottle around, I watched it like I watched the cowboys do it out of where I grew up. And you just, you know, wipe it off and just hand it to the next guy. But second time it came around, I tipped it up, and I kept it up till they took it away from me. And I got a hold of a lot of whiskey, and it was great. I had the most profound experience I ever had in my life. Nothing had touched it. I no longer felt like I didn't belong with that group in that car. I guess I felt like I owned it. It was just huge. I got a little out of hand later on at night. That night, they decided they'd sober me up, and they took me to the truck stop and filled me full of coffee. And it didn't sober me up, but it woke me up. And I took a poke at a big cowboy and paid the price. And I made a grab at the girl and paid the price. She slapped me around. And I'm still proud of that grab. So anyway, and that was the start of things. I never took a drink after that, but what I wanted to have that same effect I had that first night when I got that whiskey. You know, I was so sick the next morning, and I just couldn't wait to go get it, do it again. That was that profound an experience for me. It was just wonderful. So anyway, now let's just flash forward all the harm I caused in that, and getting thrown in and out, and stealing the kids' money and taking the grocery money, and I was not a nice man to stick around for the kids. In spite of all that, I did things I never dreamed I'd do. I came home one night and was greeted at the door, and she was upset with me, but I thought the fight was over. And so I sat down in the chair, and I'm staring at those two TVs up there. Come on, come on. And all of a sudden, crash, something comes down over my head. And I turn around, I look around, and some of you will remember the old vinyl and chrome kitchen tables and sets. The vinyl, though, had a split down the middle, and all that fuzzy cotton shit would come up out of it, excuse me. And I figured it out that she dropped that on my head. And so I jumped up, and I hit her, and I hit her hard enough that she slid on the kitchen floor 3 or 4 feet with that. And when I realized what I'd done, and I wasn't that drunk, when I realized what I was done, this sensation of horror came through me that just made me dislike myself anymore, and I didn't need any help doing that. So at any rate, and the money came first to provide my move more than the family and that. So I'm locked in the nut house. I get in this nut house, and they lock me in a room, just a square room with a bed and a window in the door about like that. And I remember I'd come to and I'd look at that window and there'd be somebody's nose up against the glass looking back in at me. And they later on they took me out and had an interview with some of them, and they asked me, hey, do you know anything about what your alcoholism is about? And I said, yeah, I think so. And they said, how do you know? How do you handle that? How do you, you know, you're aware now that you can't take another drink for the rest of your life. And the thought went through my mind, well, let me rephrase it. We're talking 50 years later now. And I remember thinking at that point, well, if I was like some of these other alcoholics I've seen on the ward here, they're 50, 60 years old anyway, how, their life's shot anyway. They don't got anything to live for, but gee. And I remember thinking that. I don't know that I answered him or not, but that was the first thought he gave to me, and I never thought much about it, but after that. While I was in there at that time, I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous, people who drive up from Salt Lake and nearby, some from the local town. And I attended my first AA meetings in there. And I'm not sure I believed what I was hearing, because as I remember, these men and women were coming in there, and they talked about this business of God, and I had no experience with God other than, it just wasn't a subject for conversation at the home I grew up in, unless you were a cousin, and it's just what it was. But at the same time, I remember my dad, during times of drought. Now, you have drought around here on occasion, but let's talk about drought out in Wyoming and that. You ever seen a green lawn turn to dust? That's what happens when it doesn't get rain and that sort of thing. And we'd be going into a drought. My dad would go over to the Mormons the next door and ask them to pray for rain. Sometimes it rained. There's a fictional character named Henry Standing Bear, who was supposed to be an Indian on the Cheyenne Reservation in Wyoming, talking about the best thing about a rain dance. The most important thing about a rain dance? Timing. That's really an aside, I'm sorry. So anyway, I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm not sure I thought much of it other than that. Don't know why I was so uncomfortable. I knew nothing about religion. And I remember the religious Christian people down the road wouldn't let their kids play with me. I thought they all should smoke cigarettes at the age of 10 or 11. I didn't say anything wrong with it, but they apparently did. With that, but it just wasn't a thing that I grew up with. But what I did is I watched the men out there, and I'd watch my dad. My dad was probably alcoholic. He drank like one, and he acted like one. And he was 5'6" tall, weighed about 130 pounds at a fighting weight, and couldn't fight worth a damn. But we drank together on occasion as I got into high school. And it worked out. So comes around, I'm in the hospital. I get a free ride to college. For some reason, when I was coming out of there, and I was really concerned about having to look for a job, so that took me out of that. I could go to college and not look for work, and ended up at the University of Wyoming in Laramie and attending my first AA meetings on the street there. They weren't quite like the ones at the Nut House, where people would drive up and share a little bit with. I remember around some people there. I think the biggest meeting we had might have had 10 people at it. And I can tell you what I never heard. I only remember one article talking about the 12 steps. One conversation in the conference with that. And I remember an old boy named Frank saying that he'd been in and out a lot. But something was different this time. He says, I took the third step this time. I've been sober longer than I've ever been in my life. And I never forgot that he said that, but I didn't forget that the following Saturday, old Frank came down drunk, and I thought, I'm never messing with that third step. And I watched that, but I somehow didn't drink. There was another younger fella in AA. At that point in time, he and I were, I was the youngest member in AA, probably in the state of Wyoming. Now, that's not saying much. You need to understand that there's more people. If you divide this area with all the communities around Akron and that sort of thing and cut it in half, you got more people than there is in the entire state of Wyoming. And so they put that in perspective with that. But I was probably the youngest alcoholic in AA in the state. And I was hearing things in AA, but none of them ever talked. We'd read the first portion of the fifth chapter, because that's how you open meetings up. But that would be the end of the conversation. Nothing would happen. I finished school quickly. I did 4 years of college and three, got a degree in accounting, because I couldn't take a vacation. I was too scared. At that time by myself, I couldn't do it. I worked a part-time job that would turn into full-time when there was Christmas vacation or things like that, because I couldn't stand to sit still. And I was attending those AA meetings. And I had a friend who would go with me who was a drug addict that had never drank. And they were allowing him to come to AA meetings, but he was the closest person of my age. And we just hung together. We lied for each other, and we did some things like that. So I got a degree finally, and I got a job in Denver. And at that point in time, let me back up a minute about that. We talked about the traditions here a minute ago with that. And the problems we're having with primary purpose as we go from group to group. And when they shortened the traditions, Alcoholics Anonymous got screwed. We were had. She read the long form of the third tradition, and the second form never touched what the long form said. It just did. And the biggest excuse you can hear is somebody who's not an alcoholic sitting in a closed meeting and saying, I have a desire not to drink. Well, big deal. Anybody on the Atkins diet has a desire not to drink because they don't want the carbs. You don't see those monkeys coming in here trying to screw up AA. You don't see that. So let me throw that out there. I got to Denver, and I'm coming back to it. So don't get so irritated you can't hear me. I don't care if you do. The Denver Young People's Group came in, and then the lingo at the time, and the closed AA meeting the Denver Young People was, is I'm an alcoholic and a drug abuser. That was a lingo, wasn't it? Way back then. And I never thought much about it because they very seldom talked about the drugs. They were generally talking about that. At the same time, the treatment industry is talking about the drug of choice. And I thought that's interesting. All of a sudden, I noticed my friend Don, who as a street sponsor, trying to show him how to live in the street when he got out of prison. He had an experience with the Big Book and 12 Steps in prison. I had to teach him that checks were money. Get in a little trouble with that. Where's that check you got Friday? What are you talking about? He missed a couple of paydays because he didn't know what the hell a check was. Anyway, I talked to Don, and he and Shelley and some of the others are just alcoholics in the meeting. They're not talking about drug abusing or any of that sort. I said, what that's about? And they said, well, the treatment center said. They talked about the drug of choice. My drug of choice, Don said to me, was meth. That's the greatest high I could experience. I really love meth. But I put meth down and walked away from it. I had to drink. I was unable to stop drinking. And I never forgot that. And that was true with Shelley, and that was true with a couple of other young ladies that were in that group. As they were alcoholic, they had to drink. They never stopped drinking. They would use other things when it seemed like the thing to do, but they found they were alcoholics. And then maybe there were one or two of them in that bunch that were both. They were truly a drug addict and an alcoholic. With that. But now we're being lumped on as everything is, a drug is a drug is a drug. Now I got a little problem with that. This is talking my experience. Take any 10 people, randomly, go out and get 10 people, and lock them in a room and give them nothing but any opiate out there. And give them that for 10 days. After 10 days, you let them out, then what do you have? You have 10 drug addicts, because opium is an addictive drug. Go out and grab another 10 random people and lock them in a room and give them nothing but booze. At the end of 10 days with nothing but booze, what do you get? You get one alcoholic. One out of 10 of us, roughly, are alcoholic. So I have a little trouble with the things that are going on today, and I'm even a little more trouble about the way we in AA are handling that, with that, and our primary purpose is suffering. So I just finished my lecture, and now I'm going to get back to my story. Please consider that, because that's made a huge difference in our life. So I end up in Denver, and I'm with these people, and we knew that the answer was the 12 steps. See, the guys that I'm meeting there, I come in at nearly 4 years sobriety, and I'm sober longer than many of them. And we know the answer is in the 12 steps. We know that, but Don was the only one that had experience with the steps via the big book. And I'm out there kind of doping around looking for an easier, softer way. And so I tried the Hazelden Guide to Inventory. I read the first 6 pages in it, and then there's a line in it there in there that says, whoa, whoa, now if you're like most of it, you're trying to read through this whole thing and all that, you need to put it down and rest a while before you do it. Well, I set that down about 45 years ago. And I don't know where it is, and I had no intentions of picking it up again. But we still knew the answers in the steps, and some of us are taking a crack at the steps as best we can. And a lot of things were happening back then. We were being touched by another group in town that now calls itself the God Squad. And they really didn't like the God Squad, because these guys were big book people. And they didn't, you came into their meeting, they didn't tolerate much other than that. If you came in, well, that's not our understanding, but here's how we took the steps via the big book and what changed in our lives. And that was their story, and they stuck with that. And so they had an influence on that that was scary. I got along real well with the most dominant figure in that group. He was a big, white-haired Scotchman lawyer with fingers, I think, were about number 45 ring size. And he'd hit me in the chest and say, listen, kid. And I listened. And so I was attracted to that group and the people in that group. I really was. Long about that time, a man from Winnipeg, Manitoba, shows up in Denver at the 1975 International and tells a story on what happens with the Golden Slippers group in Winnipeg. And I mean, bottom line that story. Mac had disappeared for a while. When he came back, something was different. But this time he came back sober. And he had this idea that they would sit down as a group and they would open their big books and they'd go through them word by word, line by line, doing precisely what it said. If newcomers showed up at their group, what time did I start? Do you remember, Dustin? Or didn't you? Okay, thank you. if somebody, a newcomer comes in, two of us will take the newcomer in the other room and we'll welcome the AA the way they ought to be. But if... that's so the group can stay on point and do what we're saying. And so they went to the book like that. Every time the book gave them a course of action to take, they took it. And every time it asked them a question, they answered it. And that's what they did. And wouldn't you know it, a few months later, the number of Golden Slippers going back out dwindled a lot. Fewer and fewer of them were going back out into huge change. And Mac had come to Denver and shared that experience with us at that. And so we went out and we started one of those over at Jay's house. We would do that. Now I had 2 or 3 things happen to me during that time. It was so important. I found out that my length of sobriety didn't influence those guys one bit. And we would read through the book. We read the doctor's opinion very carefully. I learned right there more about my first step than I'd ever heard in an AA meeting. I learned that the craving came after the first drink. The craving had nothing to do with the first drink. That was probably the worst problem with our heads, where we would go, knowing full well that if we take a drink, we're in desperate trouble. with that. So I understood the phenomenon of craving, and I understood that no matter how hard I wanted to stop drinking entirely, I was unable to do that. And I also understood, of course, that when I was drinking, I couldn't control the amount I would take, which is a fundamental definition of an alcoholic in the doctor's opinion. And so we read on through that. We read a line at the beginning of the third chapter that said we learned we had to fully concede your animal self that we're alcoholic. It's the first step to recover. Gosh, we just lost it. Anyway. Start over, Gary. We learned we had to totally concede to ourselves we're alcoholic. This is the first step of recovery. The delusion that we're anything like other people or presently maybe has to be smashed. Sorry about that. My mind seems to be doing stuff like that more often. And I don't know what it was that night, but I went home, and I seemed to have a better handle on the first step. Now, it's nothing I can intellectualize to. I thought about how would I explain that. But I was convinced, and I was convinced of my innermost self. And we went on. We got into the fourth chapter, we agnostic, your second step discussion. And like I'm saying, I'm still trying to feel this God business out. And several things were going on. I'm watching some other really sick puppies come in. And next thing you know, they're growing right past me. And they're blaming it on God. Something was changing in their lives, you know. And you could see it was changing. The guys were getting caught up on their child support payments. Their lives were changing. They had jobs and actually holding jobs and finding better jobs, you know. One guy found a job outside of the porno shop. And he thought that was a big deal. I didn't watch that. And so I'm coming to believe by watching what these other people are doing. They're talking about the experiment with God, and they talk about practicing praying, is what I call, and all these ideas. And so I'm listening careful. Same time I'm working for a bunch of tongue-talking fundamentalists, Christians, in there, and they scared me to death. One of them would go downtown in Colfax in Washington and preach on the street. And I didn't think I was ever going to do anything like that. But I'm sitting there watching that, and so I'm seeing people where I'm getting at. I'm seeing people who believe that God can do something different because it had in their life. Even though it really wasn't my thing, I don't think. But I'm listening to the AAs and watching their lives change and what they're doing is talking about God. And we're reading in the big book, and we got to this point, and we're coming to the fifth chapter. And we're looking at the prayer, the third step prayer, and we're talking about it. We get up to it, and little Lee, I'll talk about him a little bit. He was the little guy, the big mouth, that told me that the black print was on the white page, and that's all I needed to know. He was a little dramatic about how he phrased that, but he got it to me. And we listened to him this one day. He said, I think, got to back up. We started this, we called it a workshop. We didn't know that's what it was. We were just going through the big book together. And it was a fairly large co-ed group. There might have been 20, 25 of us in it. But by the point I'm talking about, when we get down to where we're approaching the third step, most of the girls have left. And I asked Lynn a couple of times, what happened? Why did you all leave? And they said, well, I can't tell you. I don't remember. She says, I don't think it was you, Gary. And so anyway, he says, before we take this third step together, I want you to understand, I would like to see us all do that together. I think we ought to read/pray the third step prayer together. Maybe we ought to stand up and hold hands. And I thought that sounded a little creepy because I was really uncomfortable having anybody see me praying. And I got to tell you, back in the middle 60s, a group of men holding hands was really unusual. He talks about that. He says, I've been in a number of meetings right now where they're talking about inventory. And they go around the room, and there'd be people in the room saying they hadn't taken an inventory yet because they hadn't taken the third step. And he says, I kind of related to that, but it looks to me the way I am in my dishonesty that we ought to do this together. And then in a couple of weeks, if I haven't taken an inventory yet and tell them it's because I'm not taking the third step yet, you can call me a damn liar because you saw me do it. And that's just the language we understood, and we said, okay, let's do that. And so I did that because the other guys were. You know, I didn't want to be the odd man out. And so we did that, and I mouthed the words. After the meeting, I got in the car, and I didn't start it up, and I asked God to please make that prayer real. I couldn't stand living that way without getting involved in the step. I was in much pain as I had been in my entire life, all those years. So I suffer more from alcoholism when I'm not drinking, if I don't have anything else, than when I'm drinking. And we don't tell people that when they come in. We'll say, gee, you'll be just fine if you stop drinking. Lie like a bunch of rugs. That happened that night, and a couple other things happened in there, and I'll share them with you. I had a night come up where I wanted to go to a small meeting down the south side, and Julie's Al-Anon meeting started at the time the meeting I was attending was ending, and I only lived maybe 5 minutes from the church where I was headed. And so we decided that our daughters could be left alone for 5 minutes while she went to the Al-Anon meeting, and I could scoot home from the AA meeting and just babysit the kids. But we finished this meeting, and I'm standing next to Big Frank. And he'd always just intimidated me no end. But after we held hands and said the Lord's Prayer, he and I sat back down. And nobody told us to, and neither one of us said anything. And I sat there and looked at him, and I said, Frank, you got to understand something. I no longer am afraid of you one damn bit. And he laughed, and when he laughed, he laughed. It was a big roar, and he threw his arms around with me, and I thought I was dead. I mean, it was going to be it. And that's all that happened. I left there that night. I get in the car and drive home, but I can't tell you for sure that my butt's in the car seat. It feels like I was floating. And I get to the house, and it was a two-story house, and our youngest daughter was in the downstairs bedroom, and I went in to kiss her goodnight. She was asleep. Kissed her anyway. And then I went upstairs, and my other two girls had their rooms upstairs, and so I went into the oldest daughter's house. A room and kissed her goodnight, and then I went into the middle daughter, and she was laying there crying. Patty had been diagnosed with ulcers at 6th grade, maybe, or 1st grade, 6 years old, 7. She's laying in there crying, and her tummy hurt. And I said, well, you want me to get you some milk? She said, please. So I went down and got the milk, and I came back upstairs. She drank the milk. And remember, I'd been working with this bunch of people in there who believed in healings and healing prayer. And I thought, I wonder how they do that. And I didn't know, but I asked Patty, I said, would you like me to pray? Shall we pray over that? And she said, yes. And so we held hands here, and I put my other hand on her tummy, and I prayed. I have no clue what I said. I couldn't have told you 30 seconds after I did it. She was asleep when I opened my eyes. And we went down, and I went downstairs, and I sat down in the chair, I think. I felt like I was floating. I've never had that experience since or anything like it. Several months later, I come home for dinner, and we were cooking green chili and Mexican food back in Denver long before it was cool. This is pretty, there's recent stuff around here, but we're cooking there and you could smell it all over the house and you came in. And the oldest girl said, oh, that smells great, Mom. And she said, but what's Patty going to eat? She can't eat that. And Patty said, I can too. She said, my tummy hadn't hurt for a long time. So do whatever you want with that, whatever it was. But that was my experience that I shared with her. Meantime, we're going into and we're reading in the big book and we're looking at inventory. We read it. We didn't read it, as I recall, as closely as we would now. If I were going to take you through the book this step, we really would be word by word, line by line going through it. I can't promise you that's what we did. But we looked at it close enough that I had a pretty good idea of what it was. Besides that, I had a three-column example in front of me that I could follow, not knowing that there's two more full pages on directions. But I looked at that, but I didn't do it till seemingly the last minute. I'm stalling it. Meantime, I'm going to the young people's group. And back then, the young people's group was we thought we were pretty slick and pretty cool. We'd go into the meeting, and it would be hugs. And if you didn't want to hug them, you gave them the peace sign. And one of the guys in there, you saw a picture of him, a tall, good-looking Mexican guy with that. And back where we grew up, that was part of life. I mean, we didn't get along. We would go fight, and then we'd go drink together. And you know, that was just life back then. And walk in there and be hugging everybody. And I'd look over at Ernie and give him the peace sign. He's missing this finger. That's only one reason I didn't like him. So anyway, he disappeared. And he hadn't been around for 2-3 weeks. And I walk in there, and one of the girls would say, gee, where's Ernie? And I'd say, don't knock it, he's gone. But he came back. And when he walked in the room, there was something different about him. You could see it. You could look him in the eye, and there was somebody home. And I don't remember anybody being there before. And he shared that he had gotten a beef with his wife, and he'd run away to Lake Whitney, Texas, and ran into a guy named Bob W., who sat him down with a big book and showed him how to write inventory. Then sent him down to an old cabin at the fishing camp and told him to come out when it's done. And whatever it was, I don't know how much time it was, Ernie came out and told Bob that he'd finished it. And Bob said, well, let's go out and get in the big boat. And Ernie thought he was going fishing. He loved to fish. They got out in the boat, and Bob turned the boat off, and he says, tell me what's in that inventory, Ernie. Ernie can't swim, so he took a fifth step. So when he came back to the group, he was different, and it was physically different, and you could see it. That night, I went home and wrote that inventory. It was that night, and I did the best I could, and I wrote all night. I quit at sunup because I didn't think I had any more to write. I added a few things to it after that. Then I ended up taking my fifth step with Ernie because I was in a situation where I didn't see anybody I liked any better than I did him. And that was the beginning of kind of a life that goes to us. We're still the best of friends, and we talk often and do a lot, and he's suffering from old man things. And that we laugh at each other because we used to laugh at the old guys that had the prostate cancer and that stuff. And then along about that time, my life is changing, my business life is changing, and don't know what we're going to do about it. And Julie and I said a prayer one night and asked what we were going to do about the business life and the business I had. And that, and the very next morning, I get a phone call from a guy who had been a member of the Denver Young People's Group and had moved to Nashville, Tennessee. And his name was Don. And he said, I'm not sure why I'm calling, but I guess I need a salesman to go out to the Midwest somewhere and work for me and sell our advertisements, our jingles and things that we make for banks and that sort of thing. And so we sat and thought about that. We just prayed last night. And so the next, that was a Monday night. And Tuesday night, I went down to the young people's closed meeting. And so I never forget it. I explained the experience like I have up to now, right now. I said, do you really think that could be an answer to prayer? And a girl that would drive all the way over from Kansas, and that's 200 miles, to catch our meeting twice a month, says it sure beats hell out of a bolt of lightning, doesn't it? And that was pretty much our answer. It took a little while to sell the house and get moved to Indianapolis, but that was the start of things to come. Keep in mind that means I left the group in Colorado that were going through the book, ended up in Indianapolis where I found 50 meetings a week. About that point in time, I think Denver had 600 or 700. And all the meetings save one were speaker meetings. And the difference in speaker meetings between there and out here in Minnesota is you only have one speaker at a speaker meeting here. Where we grew up, you would have three speakers normally. Unless the two of them are really good and could get away with it, then they moved out here, so the one speaker. I'm the new guy in town, so they have me talk around the town a lot. And so I'm sharing my experience to the 12 steps as far as I got. And that went on. It took me probably, got there in 77, and I think the first time I got it, was able to get a group of people together to go through the big book, God forbid, and the 12 steps, and I think it took about 3 years. And my favorite redneck came to me one day, or called me one day. He says, I want to have one of those groups at our house like you did in Denver. And take people. We go through the book and take the steps. And I said, great. And he said, you come, won't you? And I said, sure. I wouldn't miss him. And so we did that. Now, what I didn't tell you, let me flash back. We did that third step prayer together back in Colorado. And 14 of us took it. And 13 of us have either died sober or are still sober. The 14th one, Eddie D, went out and drank and froze to death. So 13 out of 14 of us, that's quite a record. I don't think you could find that track somewhere else with that. Used to be, Eddie would go out and do that for a while. Eddie had a wooden leg, and every time he'd go out and drink, he'd lose his damn leg. And so I'll bet I was out with the other guys looking over in Denver trying to find that leg when he'd come back in. And when he was sober, he was the best 12-stepper I ever worked with. He was phenomenal at it. I loved grabbing him to go take. We had some really good luck when he was along. But anyway, we started this thing in Indianapolis. And let me tell you something. We lost one there. I hope he didn't freeze to death and lose a leg. We don't know what happened to him. But 14 of us finished that. And from that one, the guys and gals in that group went off in twos and threes and found other people to sit down and go through the big book with like we had done before. Now, that would have been 1980 or 81. And if you went to a speaker meeting in Indianapolis, the odds are the speaker that's there is going to talk to their experience of going through a 12-step workshop there as being a significant turnaround in their lives in AA. There are still AA groups in Indianapolis that still don't know about the big book and working steps. And they're pretty good. There are groups in Indianapolis that work steps and maybe use the 12 and 12. And wonder why I don't use the 12 and 12, and I don't answer them if I can help it. I don't do it because my belief is, I forgot just how it is. The big book calls the 12 and 12. And I don't want to misquote this, that's why I'm looking it up. Because I'm liable to make stuff up. An interpretive commentary on the AA program by a founder. I don't know you, but when I'm studying the textbook, I don't bother with the interpretive commentaries on what somebody says and with that sort of thing. So that's primarily why we don't. So what I'll do is I take you through the book and the steps and get you going on it to where you're confident. Then I'll suggest you go to the 12 and 12. Because that way, there are very few instructions in the 12 and 12. But there's a lot of stuff to relate to. You know, particularly when they're about selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, fear. the things we do. So I don't want to badmouth it, but I don't think that's the primary thing either. I think our primary text, the big book, is the thing that works best, helping the alcoholics to get sober. I moved to Indianapolis. Let's back up a minute. Right here. Let's go back to right name of Troy. As many of you know in here, we talk about four-column inventory here. If you look at the example, it only shows three, and then you have two more pages away when you see what we say goes in the fourth column, okay? Big Frank and his group say there's no fourth column in the big book. What they say is make the third step work for you. If you need to, put that what we call fourth column information in your third step. Use a red pencil. And some wise guy like me will say, well, he told me to put it in black and white. But that's not the thing to say to Frank. And that's the important thing. So we talked about that, and we did that. And we found we got a great deal of help in looking at the inventory. Pages 62 and 63 are probably the most important pages in our book right now. It tells the sober person that selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of our problem. That's it. Think about it today. I'm sober a long time, and I don't know, is anybody in here with more than 50 years? I got to tell you, if I'm aware and looking at my life, and that sort of thing, I still can't believe that most of my think is selfish and self-centered. What, 90-95%? It really isn't thinking about necessarily the guys I sponsor. I know it should be, and they come to mind often, but it's my selfishness and self-centeredness that's going on. And so where I'm going with that now is we become in touch with that more than we do just reading that. What those pages on 62 and 63 tell us very clearly, and you can wrap it up in a brief sentence, if I'm not the problem, there ain't no answer. I'm it, period. I can't blame none of this on anybody else. Any number of people I've met that here were abused as children come into AA, and they'll sit down in my workshops and say, well, what do you do about that? I was completely innocent. Am I coming? Yeah, at that moment you were. How about today when you're using that as an excuse to behave badly? I mean, we've done it and all that. I was asking a workshop in Staten Island a few years ago. There was a group of people in there, women, most LGBT group, about six or seven, great bunch of gals. They participated regularly, and they were really a part of them. But one of them asked Jerry and I up at the podium, well, what about those of us that were handled badly, were sexually, as children and that sort of thing? And Jerry is a real kind young man. And so I put my hand on him and I said, let me answer this. And I looked at her and I said, do you have anything more you'd like to add about that? And she matched me just staring in the eye and saying back and back, she says, no. I said, are you telling me you use that for an excuse to behave like a bitch? And those women cracked up. They love it. I got the message in that this woman had been trying to explain to those other gals in there that's what they're doing. And so they got the answer for it. Now, the guys can behave like bitches too, okay? But this is important stuff to find in inventory. We got the resentment at so-and-so, or maybe it's the other parent so-and-so who watched this happen and didn't do anything about it. I mean, there's any number of manifestations to it. But it all boils back to our selfishness and our self-centeredness, no matter what happened to us in our earlier lives. And so I just kind of want to throw that out. I may talk about what I found in inventory more. Daryl and I were listening on the ride out here yesterday about there's a lie that goes on in our inventories with that. And Big Frank used to call it the theater of the lie. And I would never try to teach this to a person taking a first-time inventory, but it can be fairly helpful later on. Kind of, we go into those inventories as a different kind of character. When we're asked in third column how it affects my self-esteem, that's an interesting question. The lie is we don't have low self-esteem or high self-esteem. We just have self-esteem. And generally, if I am offended some way or another, I'm either too good, my self-esteem says I'm too good to be treated that way, or I'm too bad to be treated that way. I deserved it. You know, I don't deserve anybody to treat me nicely. And stuff like that. So there's so much you can learn with that. It kind of throw out. Didn't mean to get stuck here, but I'm going to go a little further and then we'll take a break for a while. At 20 years sobriety, the reason I'm skipping for that long is I hadn't done anything with the step between five from that point at that point in time. At 20 years of sobriety, I was sober. I was living in Indianapolis. I was kind of the only person in town that had done any circuit speaking, and that all that does is give people with a head like mine a lot of trouble. Or I give myself, and. I guess I got to thinking that I was something that I wasn't. Since I had a job that was really a pretty good job for me, but all of a sudden it wasn't working, and that's because I was chasing women. I was being dishonest in other areas of my life. And I'm learning a lesson that we all learn to some degree or another coming in. The person who's trying to live a spiritual life or thinks they are, if he tells a lie in one part of his life, it affects all three parts of his life. I told a lie about my sex life. Let me think. Wilson explains that in the 12 call. He calls it security, prestige, and romance. Let's call it money, power, and sex. Okay. So I'm lying about my sex life. All of a sudden, I'm unable to earn any money. That just goes right out the window. And my friends in AA are steering clear of me. My best friend at that point in time in Indianapolis was a guy named Earl, and I'd sponsored him into AA, he just died about 6 weeks ago. I sponsored him the whole time. And I still get that. Every time I think of him and all that, I kind of choke up a little. I don't need to, but we were wonderful friends. But he saw me doing that, and he kind of stood clear of me. And then a day came when another guy that I was sponsoring, Big Bo Hump from the steel mills in Pittsburgh, he explained it to me in a language that I understood. Quit it, stupid. I knew that. But I was at that point, and I was at a bottom. A guy from, I'll tell that part later. So I went home, and I called a guy in Chicago named Paul, who was the oldest sobriety I knew personally in my life at that time. And Paul had been on the circuit for years and years, and not the most liked because he was a 12-step Nazi. And he very clearly believed, and to the day he died, you never check, that the AA program is the 12 steps taken in order, and it never tells us to stop taking them. And so I called him, and what I said was, is there any possibility that a guy, a 40-some-year-old, I can't remember the exact year, man with 20-some years of sobriety and a grandfather could be going through male menopause? And he said, yeah, probably. But if you were to go out and review your first three steps in depth, write another inventory, and come up here and take some fifth steps, make your amends, your life will change, and I promise you that'll do that. And I said, Paul, I'll do anything you tell me. And I said that with more desperation than I ever said that when I first came in. Please understand that. We were talking earlier about the desperation to get in and take the steps. The most successful people at the steps come in desperate and in need of a huge change in their lives when they do that. And I was. And I'll tell you the rest of that after we come back from our break.
Thank you.